If you want to be social, this is the Pure Imagination event. So you can actually reply or mention Purely Imagine or use the hashtag Win8PI. Or you can do Pure Imagination on Facebook as well. So if you want to tweet about this particular presentation, then just tweet with these two hashtags there, and then people will, see the feedback and do some analysis on the Twitter feed and different things like that. So if you have some feedback even after the presentation on this and say how awesome that I am and those online, you can start tweeting and stuff like that. You can use Cloud 4 Win 8PI. So this is the fourth session in the cloud track of day two of Pure Imagination. If I start rambling, it's because I was participating in the hackathon until about 3 a.m. this morning. And so we'll see how this goes. So what my presentation is focused on is on building device applications with Windows Azure and augmenting your applications with cloud services so that you can make them a little more global and do a lot, different situations and stuff like that. So what I'm really going to be talking about is storage, HTTP services, communications, platform services like notifications. Don't be shy, come on in. What it's all about is making it easy for your applications to connect to the cloud and to connect to other devices, other applications, other users, save data, just be more than just that phone, right? You can only do so much with the phone. You can do a variety of different things, like a service or a phone. They have tons of processing power in them compared to how they what they used to a long time ago. But really, in a lot of cases, you need more power, more processors, more storage, right, than it's available on the phone. So why would you actually care about the cloud when you're building a device application? So what I was saying is that it allows for new application scenarios like video rendering, image rendering, lots of processor-heavy scenarios, cross-communication, social applications, right? You can't really be social when you're just around people and using I don't even know what you would use, ad hoc connections or some sort of thing. Like, you need a central system in order to connect and communicate with other devices. So the cloud levels the playing field. What I mean by that is, there's a variety of different devices, form factors, capabilities, processors, SDKs, for all of these different things like Windows, iOS, Android, BlackBerry, whatever. What I'm going to show you is how to build a very easy API that you can actually use online and communicate with any device. It's a very basic HTTP endpoint. And if your device can load a web page, it supports HTTP, right? So we're talking about any phone, any platform, you can use HTTP. So by having a cloud service that takes care of all of your business logic or any of your communications, you're leveling the playing field. You're saying, I don't have to write all this logic on a variety of different platforms. I can just put it in the cloud. The last one is that the cloud provides a central repository or kind of switching stations to, connect to other applications on the cloud and stuff like that, or other applications connected to your other devices, connected to your application. So there is a few different cloud offerings out there and different ways of consuming the cloud. So why Windows Azure and why Platform as a Service? Let's see. I can actually, what are your options as far as cloud platform? One of your options, I think we've showed this slide before in a few presentations, but it's a little bit different for this one. When you're using on-premise, you actually control and you're responsible for the entire stack, right? Everything from if your hardware fails, your virtualization platform fails, operating system fails, network fails, firewall failure, native code failure, custom software failure, or bug, any problem in your data and any problem in your application. That is the possibility of a lot of problems, a lot of responsibilities. So when you go into the cloud, there are a couple of a few options that can take away some of the responsibilities. The first one is a fairly new concept for Windows Azure, but not necessarily for other cloud platforms. But you can actually just get a server, right? So if you get a server that's virtualized and hosted, right, you're still responsible for the operating system up, right? The most difficult one in this particular case is the OS, right? You have to patch your own OS. Cloud services is more of a platform as a service structure, and that's what I'm going to be starting to talk about, everything on and above this point. Hey, how's it going? And so cloud services takes away that operating system. So from this point on, I'm going to show you a couple more options. Your OS gets patched automatically. You don't have to worry about that. That takes away a lot of support costs. Mobile services is a really great service that was introduced to provide just these different features and your application, your data, authentication, notifications, and stuff like that. It's really, really robust and really flexible. But what I'm going to be talking about today is the lowest footprint of all these options, which is Windows Azure websites. I'm actually not going to delve very deep into Windows Azure websites because Atlee is going to be coming here after this. And he's going to be digging into what the scaling options for Windows Azure websites are, pricing options, and all of the nuances. But basically, what I'm going to say is Azure websites is an IaaS hosting service that you can deploy ASP.NET, PHP, Node.js, and a variety of other languages and platforms on this service and have them in a scalable environment for your applications. So I'm going to go back to the slide that I had out of order. So why would you use Windows Azure? Why would you pick websites and platform as a service? If you built it, Azure can run it. If it runs on Windows Server, it can run on Azure, right? If PHP can run on IIS, it can run on Azure. Python can run on IIS, it can run on Azure, right? We are not limited to .NET and ASP.NET. I'm going to be showing you some ASP.NET today, but that is not a limit for you in the cloud. And there's a variety of other options that if you're in any sort of Azure Talks, they would just do some hand-waving around elasticity. It's easy to scale up and down and all that other fun stuff. I'm not going to really be talking about that kind of thing. And then at the bottom here, there is a number of services that will help you out when your application becomes a lot more advanced, like caching, CDN, Traffic Manager. Traffic Manager is actually a global endpoint that sits on top of all of the Azure data centers in the world, all six of them. Actually, no, I think there's eight of them now. I could be wrong. And it actually has a global endpoint for your application. So you could say, my application is channel9.com, but if I was in Asia, I'm getting channel9.com in Eastern Asia. If I was in North America, I'm getting channel9.com in North America. So if your application gets global and you need, you're having trouble with that round trip all the way to North America for your application, and you can foot the bill to have another instance of your app running in another data center, you can use Traffic Manager to figure out where your user is actually requesting from and locate them in that data center. That's just one example of the variety of options and extra services that are provided by Azure that you can utilize once you start kind of picking up speed. So I kind of went through all of these. And we're going to be talking about websites today and minimizing the footprint that you have for your responsibilities. And there's clouds at the bottom. So those are your options as far as compute, right? How to actually host your application logic. These are your options as far as hosting your application data, right? As far as application data goes, there are three options for regular Windows Azure storage, which is very flexible, very scalable storage. The third talk of the day today, the last talk, is going to be me up here again, talking a little more in depth into all these options and saying when you would use them, when you wouldn't use them. But for now, they're there. They're available to you. And I'm going to be talking very briefly about them in a couple of different examples and code tours that I'm going to be doing. So there's three main options as far as Windows Azure storage. Then you have a SQL database option, right? SQL Azure or Azure on SQL on Azure, which is a little bit different. Hosting a SQL machine in the cloud is a little bit different than using the SQL Azure data as a service endpoint. Now, what kind of options do you have, or what I'm going to be talking about as far as UI is Windows 8. So I'm kind of going to jump back and forth between Windows 8 and Windows Phone 8. Because they all run on the same runtime now. You can use JavaScript and HTML on both and WinRT and all this other fun stuff. But the main thing is that we're going to be using HTTP client, which is a very thin, very simple transfer client. And we're going to be showing how easy that actually is. So just to get right into it, after I drink some water, connectivity. So the ASP.NET stack, or the Microsoft stack, for very simple basic connectivity is MVC Web API and HTTP client. So these are kind of reversed in my head because you'd think they would be HTTP client. This is the client side. This is the server side. So on the client side, we're generating HTTP requests, just like a website request, get, post, delete, put, stuff like that. And then on the server side, we just have very simple methods that accept those requests. So what does that actually look like? I'm hoping that people will be able to see lots of this stuff here. Yeah, you can see it. I'm actually kind of talking to those online that I can't see. So this is my client, right? This is main page XAML.cs, right? This is a very basic code behind for a page. And I'll just show you quickly what this will do in my simulator. So I'm loading up my application. This application uses geolocation, and generally my IP address is in Toronto, so I don't have full geolocation on my laptop, but with the simulator I can change it a little bit. In fact, I'll leave it as it is. So what this application actually does is it allows you to actually take pictures and then say this picture actually came from this geolocation. How does it actually do that is if I right-click and take a photo, and this will be from my webcam, so hi. Capture, there. And then I kind of choose a section here, like so. Let's see. How do I get rid of this? Anyway, so it's actually uploading that photo to a blob, and it doesn't actually do a lot of UI. It's not really about the UI. If you want UI, you can go to the design track. Please don't leave. It's about how you actually interact with that on the server side. So what is it actually doing? When the position changes, it keeps track of the position, and it actually does get points of interest every time the position changes. It's actually setting up the geolocator, and I believe there's a default interval, so every time that it actually gets a position. Obviously, you might want to change that because if it's getting the point of interest every half a second and querying your server, and you're going to have a few users, you're going to kill your server pretty quickly. So what this is actually doing here is saying HTTP client equals new HTTP client, using the await async await keywords. We're actually just doing a GET request to my server using the radial search URL, current location latitude and current location longitude, and this, I believe, is the radius that it's actually looking for. So it's doing a string format on this URL, the radial search URL, and you can actually see that I have API location, latitude, longitude, radius, and meters. Right, so it's filling in the string format 0, 1, and 2 with some of my inputs. So what does this actually look like when it gets over the wire and goes onto the server? Well, luckily, I can stop my application, and I can show you the server code for this in this other project. So because my URL says API location, and I'm using ASP.NET MVC, I know by convention that I'm hitting the location controller. Right, so after the URL and it says API, the name of the controller is next. So I've got a couple of different ones. I've got a blob SAS controller and a location controller. So this is my GET request for the radial search right down here, and I'm going to close that so you can see all of it. So this is the only code that I actually have to write in order to handle this request, right? A method that says get, and it has a latitude, longitude, and radius in meters. That's it. Because the names of, because this method is called get, automatically I'm handling a get HTTP request. Because I have a property called latitude, I'm handling a query string property called latitude, right? It's very convention based. So I didn't have to configure in some sort of XML file somewhere that this is the signature of my, you know, endpoint and a lot of that hoopla. It's very easy. If I want to change any of this, I can just change it from latitude to, you know, something else, or add a parameter here, an optional parameter that I can make nullable for usage in a different you know, version of the application, right? Obviously, I need to be aware of how my clients are actually using this endpoint when I'm making any changes, right? But my contract is not terribly strict. So I can very easily take that, those double values and int radius values and query and return enumerable points of interest. And points of interest is just a basic, actually, here, I'll go to points of interest on the client side. So points of interest is just a basic .NET common language runtime object, or a plain old CLR object with auto properties, right? And it serializes this object into JSON and not XML. And the reason that it serializes it into JSON is in my main page .cs, let's see, get points of interest, I have a data contract JSON serializer, right? I believe I'm actually setting up the client as a JSON client somewhere as well. But I'm actually saying I want JSON, right? I'm saying to the server, the type of request that I'm making right now is JSON, so it knows that, you know, if it didn't say anything by default, it would return the JSON object. But I can also say, give me this in XML, give me this in OData, give me this in an image or whatever, right? You can write in hooks into your web API so that you can actually return your objects and data in any format that you want, or any format that's requested, which is a very flexible structure, because you can basically make a server side that a variety of clients, or even clients you may not know about. People can be consuming this API from clients that you didn't even know about, right? Android or whatever. You have third-party vendors creating applications for you, and they say, oh, well, yeah, that's JSON is great, but I really want XML. You're like, oh, okay, great. Just request XML, and you'll get XML. Oh, okay. Right, it's very, very flexible for the actual consumer of this API. So that's how easy it is to actually get data over the wire using data contract JSON serializers, using query strings, and using web API. There's a couple of other examples that I'll go into later, but this is basically a GET request. But I can go to the location controller. When I'm creating a point of interest, it's just this request right here that's just a POST request, and it takes a point of interest object, which I've serialized into JSON on the client side as like the body of the message, right? So it automatically takes that object and deserializes it into a point of interest object, right? I don't have to have a strict contract in this case. I can just say this is a JSON object. It has properties, right? It's a dynamic object, right? You can be a little bit more fluid if you want to be, but if you want to be strict about the object that's being passed in adheres to these properties, I know that they should exist. Throw an error if they don't exist, right? That kind of strictness, you can definitely do that. So anyway, this is just a quick overview of ASP.NET Web API. So there's tons of documentation, videos, and everything online on mvc.asp.net that you can actually go and see more features, rich features of ASP.NET Web API and a lot of that kind of stuff. But I have to kind of mention as well that there are the kind of ecosystem or options that you have. I'm only focusing on doing websites and hosting ASP.NET. Like, as you saw with that range of options that I was showing before, you have mobile services at your disposal, which does something similar to this, but in Node.js and JavaScript on the server side. You have, you know, cloud services available, which you can run native code on, so you can run Ruby code, host your Ruby applications, your Ruby endpoints on there. And so there's a variety of options for you. I'm just kind of highlighting what I think is probably the simplest and most flexible option, right? Where you can just quickly expose an endpoint for a GET and PUT and POST requests and pass data from the client to the server. So anyway, that's probably enough on this particular demo, just kind of like a quick little code tour of ASP.NET Web API. So on the screen, I want to show you a couple different things as I grab some water here. So why does it matter that I control actually what format the result is in, and I care about using JSON? Now, you know, to be the most flexible, you can obviously use as many different types of serialization as you want, but this is OData, probably one of the larger common web types. SOAP is even larger than this. So if you're using WS Star Services and WCF and you're using SOAP, you know, you probably want to rethink doing that on an actual device, because people will be using your device on mobile networks, on networks that are somewhat connected or not very performant. But OData, the data set is 8.5K. If you strip that down to just basic REST XML, so this is just serialized XML with no fluff among Atom and OData, it is still 1.2K. Let's look at that in JSON, 639 bytes, right? So you're talking about a significant reduction in the amount of data that's actually transferring over the wire. And when people are actually paying to use your application and paying to use the data in your application, then this becomes very, very important. So that's communication, right? So we talked about a few things like the different types and serialization methods you can use, different REST endpoints like GET and POST and PUT endpoints, how to create those in Web API. It's really, really easy. If you have MVC 4.0 or you have Visual Studio 2012, you automatically have MVC 4.0 installed. And you can just say new application, Web API application, and it'll start you off in the right direction. You have a lot of the same controllers that I had there, and you can start writing code. Very, very easy stuff to do communication. Now, that's all well and good when you want to communicate between your device and your application logic. But what if your device actually stores stuff in the cloud? What if you're actually using files that you want to share between devices, share between users, or they're just too large for a smaller device like a phone or a tablet? So what are our different options for Windows Azure Storage? I was talking about these a little bit before. There are three main Windows Azure options in tables, blobs, and queues that can be used for a variety of different things. So tables, you have non-relational but still structured storage. This is not the same as SQL, right? SQL, you have the benefits below there of a relational database. Tables is a non-relational. That can be a benefit or a hindrance depending on your problem, depending on the solution that you want to build. You may just want very, very basic, large amounts of data in column formats that you just want to throw into the cloud, and tables will allow you to do that. And it even allows you to do that in a very flexible way where you can actually have rows that have, you know, four columns and then some rows that have five. Some rows that this column is a different data type than the others, right? It's very, very flexible compared to SQL, which has a strict schema. And then blobs. So when we're talking about websites, but more like cloud services and some of the cloud systems, you don't want to rely on the local I/O of your cloud system, because it's possible that that I/O may die, and you may need to have your application redeployed onto another server. So your servers should be as stateless as possible when you're dealing with the cloud, right? So you can scale up and scale down at will and not worry about data being deleted or changed. So when you're actually looking at saving to the file system, like in your head, think of an application that uses file.io, right, to save files, right, and take something and page it to a disk or something like that. Now, with the cloud, you're now using Windows Azure Blobs, right? It's kind of the direct comparison to the file system. It's just a file system in the cloud. And you can have directories, metadata, and all this other stuff on blob entries, just like you would have in files. So that's when you would actually use blobs. So now queues, you can use it for very rough, persistent async messaging. So you can enqueue and dequeue messages from a queue so you can communicate between layers of your application. From your actual mobile device, you can queue up work being done or messages for different mobile users, different things like that. And then for the last one at the bottom is Windows Azure SQL Database. So there's a couple different options with that, like I was mentioning before, SQL Azure or SQL on Azure. And I'm going to be talking about that in the last session today. But it's fairly straightforward SQL. You know, you have fully relational. You can have foreign keys, multiple tables, locks, triggers, stored procedures, all that other fun stuff. And in your SQL database. So if you have a very data-rich application that has a very complex domain of objects and data, then you would want to drop to SQL Azure because table storage is not going to be good enough for you. So how do we actually use these storage mechanisms? They're in the cloud, right? I can't just point at a machine and say, if I have access to this machine, or if I'm on the domain, I have access to the database. There is no domain. There is no machine. Everything's in the cloud. So how we actually do authentication for these storage mechanisms is using storage names and secret keys, or in the case of SQL Azure and SQL Database, usernames and passwords, right? You have the SQL logins instead of domain logins, right? This SQL Azure is not on domain. So if you actually looked at your storage accounts, this is in the old portal, but if you looked at your storage account, you have a primary and a secondary access key. That's the storage key that you would actually need to use in signing your requests to put data into table, blob, and queue storage. and then in your connection strings, you actually have the ID of your user, DBA, and then that's the server name, which is a pretty convoluted set of numbers and letters, and then your password, which is directly into that connection string. And when you are doing that, definitely look at how to encrypt your connection strings on ASP.NET servers. It's definitely capable of doing in IIS. Or have this included in an encrypted file and different things like that. Because that is username and password. And you can invoke security on those particular users so that they are specific to your application and can only access tables and schemas that your application can access. So the problem is, especially when you're dealing with devices, you cannot send these secret keys out to any devices, right? As soon as somebody gets access to your storage name and storage key, they have full admin access to that data. They can read, write, delete, do whatever they need to do, right? So that is a secret key that you want to keep on your server side at all times. Same with the SQL access. You cannot give somebody, like the firewall rules in Azure would prohibit it anyway, but you should not and cannot give anyone full SQL access from their phone, right? That's not happening. Obviously, you need something in the middle to broker these connections and monitor the authorization authentication of your users. So how do we actually do that? In most cases, I'm going to go through different options for different storage mechanisms because some of them have more capability to be used directly on the device themselves while keeping a kind of secrecy. But in this particular case, you actually need to proxy the request. So right here, we have a quick little screen here that has a phone or you can say a tablet, any sort of device, a web role or a website, something that's running in Windows Azure that's taking the request like I was showing you before, and then table storage. So what happens is the client sends data to the web role. The web role then, using its secret key, sends data to the table storage, right? And then it gets a response. Oh, wait, hold on, sorry. And then it gets a response, and it says, yeah, that's done. The same thing happens with reading data, right? If it wants a certain set of data, it sends that request to the website or web role, and then it requests the actual storage account and then proxies the data back to the client. So an alternative to that is actually using shared access signatures. A shared access signature is the same as a secret key, but it's a secret key that has a certain level of permissions and expires at a certain time. So you're giving them access to a subset of your storage for a certain level of time. So what happens is your client makes a request to the web role or website in this case for a shared access signature, and then the web role sends a shared access signature back after talking to the storage and generating said signature. And then what you can actually do is have the client directly make the request to your blob storage. This is shared access signature is mainly used on blobs, and I'll show you some code and actually how this works in a moment. So now that the client has basically a temporary key for writing data to Blob, it can do it itself. You're not kind of in the middle anymore. This is especially really, really good for highly scalable applications where you're uploading pictures and stuff like that, mainly because your web role and website is not using the bandwidth and the sockets and I/O connections to actually take in these images. So your users would go to you as the website and say, hey, I have an image to upload. And instead of passing the image to that site, the response just comes back and says, great, put it over here, right? Gives you a full URL with a shared access signature that you can put a put request to and actually upload that blob to Windows Azure. And then after it's done, you just go, okay, yeah, I'm done. I uploaded it. It went fine. We're good. So it sends a response back, and sometimes it'll go and tell the website that it finished properly. So SQL database is it's the same kind of proxying mechanism, especially when you're dealing with, stored procedures and stuff like that that have certain responses. You can proxy the response back to the client. Now, this is not terribly scalable because, you know, every one of these types of requests requires a round trip to the database. So you can put a caching role kind of in the middle there to alleviate some of the read pain or some of the pain of database access if you're getting like huge amounts of reads compared to writes and different things like that. But it is like a full proxying round trip to the database and then to the client. Now, queues are another mechanism like blobs the contract is simple enough that the client can actually use the contract itself. So you still do the same thing with a shared access signature, or a client can basically own their queue, right? You can have so many queues that every user of your application basically has their own queue. And that works very well for sending them messages, right? And logging into your application and saying, hey, do I have any messages, is as easy as, hey, check my queue. Is there anything in my queue, right? Different things like that. So your client actually writes a message to the queue. The worker role, the background process on your cloud system, actually is watching the queue and like constantly checking it and saying, hey, every second, do you have messages? Do you have messages? Do any of these queues have messages? And it's pulling that queue, returns the message back. Oops. So what the worker role will do is it will actually, you know, churn away on that worker process that's much too complex to do actually on the client side. So one example of this is that you just took a fairly large picture, right? And you want to actually render that picture in like Sepia or do some, you know, analysis or rendering on that picture. You would use the shared access signature blob section to get a shared access signature, right? Upload your picture to the blob, and now put a message in your queue saying, hey, I uploaded this picture and I want this rendering done on it, right? So your queue is being handled by your worker role that's doing some just processing, churning away. It picks up that blob that the device has uploaded, renders it, creates another blob with the rendered image, and then puts a message in another queue or sends a notification to the client through the notification service that such and such is done. You can go download this new image that I've rendered, and you're all good, right? Sometimes these processes can take a number of minutes, a number of hours, depending on, you know, how much processing you're actually doing, and it's not something that you can actually do on the phone itself. So you're basically queuing up work for a background process to perform, and then using another queue or notifications to say whether or not that work has actually been completed. So, how does this blob storage with shared access signature stuff actually work? So let's go back to my party server, so where I am uploading images of certain locations. So let's see. I actually have another controller called a blob SAS controller. So I want to say I'm going to upload a blob to this container and this blob name. So it's doing a GET request on the shared access signature or for the container and the blob name. So let's see. This is just basically a bunch of code that says, I want to connect to this blob storage account, create a blob client, get this blob container, create it if it doesn't exist. And let's see. So the access type is public access for blob. So this container is a public container. Anybody can read to this container, but we want to control who can actually write to this container. So we actually create a shared access policy called my policy, and we set the write permission on this policy, and we actually say that it's going to expire in 4 hours from now. Right? So maybe it might take a little while to upload this file from the client, depending on how their internet speed is going. So this this thing is going to expire in 4 hours. So what we're actually doing here is we're setting the permissions, getting the shared access signature for my policy, and actually returning that shared access signature attached at the end of my blob. So a string format. So what this is doing is it's generating a URL with a key that's attached to it in a query string that basically says, if you upload to this URL, I'm okay. You can do that. You have write permissions to this URL. Because it has that SAS or that shared access signature sitting on the end of it. So what does that actually look like on the client side? So what we're actually handling here is the on take photo click. Right? So what we're, this is a pretty deep if statement, and I probably, if this was my code, I'd probably refactor it a little bit. But what we're doing is we're saying get async on the blob SAS area, and we're going to call it my test container, and then the media name. So this has a little bit of a flaw that if I actually upload the same file, right, with two different names, it's actually going to replace it. But I should know that as the client and everything like that. But so what this is actually doing, the response is an HTTP response that contains a URL. It's just a string that is the URL for my shared access signature. So if I actually say response.content, read string async, and that is my SAS URL. I trim a little bit of the URL, and then I open my file stream, and then upload using this file stream. I actually upload. Let's see. Hold on a second. Yeah. So the upload image request. Where is that? Yeah. Sorry. This is actually the client.putAsync. And so the putAsync takes the SAS URL in URI form, and it's basically saying, you gave me access to this URL, now I'm putting a set of data onto this URL. And if that upload response is good, I actually serialize a new point of interest and say, I've uploaded my image, so now I'm going to actually finish up my workload and create a point of interest that responds to that image. So there's the add POI endpoint here. So I'm actually calling two different endpoints, right? So obviously you need to take care of what happens if one of these things fails, right? One of the main things here is that if my put async for the, point of interest fails, then I have a problem because I have an image sitting up there that's basically orphaned, right? So obviously because you're calling two different things, this is a fairly large, a little bit larger workflow. You need to take care of what would happen in errors. But this is just a small demo application, so hopefully it's not, I'm going to be put into production. So essentially that is a pretty complex scenario, but that's how you would like offload your upload of images to blob storage using shared access signatures. Identity. So one of the really main benefits of having services is governance over who's actually accessing your service. I don't have a demo on this, but I'll just kind of talk about this. What are your options for identity? You can actually write your own or implement the regular ASP.NET membership database to say, okay, well, I'm just going to allow users to register and create usernames and passwords and all this other stuff. So I'm the one that's actually managing how those passwords are hashed. if you can, you know, request a new password or reset your password, how you reset your password with questions and different things like that, how many times you can reset your password in a certain amount, how many times you can try and enter your password. There's a whole lot of features that are around identity that if you were doing it yourself, it would be a problem or a very, very big investment. So some people don't really want to take on that large investment, right? If you're doing something very customized, you can kind of just, you know, write your own identity server. But most people don't really want to do that. So they actually want to use a single existing identity system, like their Active Directory server or Facebook or Google, LiveID. There's a bunch of, you know, as we were talking about in another cloud track, people putting their hand up, how many, like, so I'll ask you guys, how many people here have more than 5 identities on the internet somewhere? Oh yeah, definitely. You know, like you have all of these services that you have created a username and password for. Sometimes you have applications just for managing the passwords for all those services, right? It can get pretty intense. And every time you create a new service for somebody to use, it often you don't really want them to say, oh, you have to create a new identity for this. Especially if it's on a Windows 8 or Windows Phone 8 device, because you can actually log into the device using a Live ID. So why can't you actually use that Live ID for all of your applications? Right? That's very, very possible and very easy to do with Windows 8. Now, the third option, right, using a single identity system, you can do that with mobile services very, very easily if you're creating a mobile services service. Or you can outsource your identity management to another Azure service that's called the Access Control Service, otherwise known as Windows Azure Active Directory. So it's basically a system that allows you to broker settings for who is allowed to provide identities for this application, and how long they provide identities for, and where they get those identities, and what login websites they use, and stuff like that. So the Access Control Service is quite a complex scenario. So I'm just going to talk about how that works. So you have a user with a device or on a computer, and they want to access your funnel, your website or web role or whatever on Windows Azure. So what do? So they have a URL, and they try and access your site, right? No authentication, no authentication headers. They just say, like, hey, give me that data over there. It comes back with a response that says, no, I trust Access Control Service. So you go log in with Access Control Service and come back when you have an authentication token. So the user gets redirected to the Access Control Service, and the Access Control Service has a number of websites that it will actually send to the user and say, like, okay, these are the different login options that you have for this service. You can log in using Facebook, Live ID, Yahoo, Google, and or Active Directory. You have a lot of different options. You can pick one of them, right, and just say, hey, log in here, and it'll redirect to that login page. But you can also give the user the ability to choose how they actually want to log into your application. So when they click on one of those things, they go to their favorite login provider. It opens up a window, it redirects them to a login page, and they put in their username and password for Facebook, and Facebook will actually give them a token and redirect them back to ACS. So ACS now knows, hey, you've logged in with one of my favorite identity providers. You gave me a valid token. I can confirm that it hasn't been tampered with. It's provided by a secure and trusted token provider. So I'm actually going to, you know, run some rules on that token and convert it to a usable other kind of token, right? A application token for your Windows Azure application. And it sends that token back to the user, and then it now has a request with an authentication header, right? So it's really, you know, it's a lot of steps, just like the previous thing, right? We're calling a lot of services, so things could fail in this structure. But it happens really, really fast. Lots of times when you're using applications that need to re-authenticate with Live or re-authenticate with Facebook, you don't even know that happens because this orange line here could be just a cookie, right? It hits the Facebook login page. You already have a cookie for Facebook that says, remember me. It already logged you in. It gave you a new token, right, that expires in 3,000 seconds or whatever it is. So why do we actually have the access control? So we have it for what's kind of known as claims enrichment. So you can actually have a variety of providers that may change their claim structure at any point in time because they don't really care about you. They'll change the way that they do authentication. They'll add a claim. They'll change their claim signature and their unique ID for the claim. But since you have access control between your application and your identity providers, you can just change your rules and say, oh yeah, well, Google, well, they are being a pain, and they actually use a different schema name that's more open source than the one that I use. So just change that schema name to the one that I like, and we'll just keep going. Right? So you can actually massage the claim, the token that actually comes from your identity provider, into a form that's consumable by your application, and you have a sort of governance service that sits in the middle that you can manage change and keep your application running when identity providers change the how they do things. Or if you want to add another one or remove one. And then once they actually provide an authentication token, they can actually get your site and access your logic. Now, the main benefit of doing this and doing claims-based or token-based authentication is that the funnel and the Windows Azure website or web role there has no concept of a password. No concept of resetting passwords, of saving them, encrypting them, none, right? It doesn't care how or in what method they were authenticated. It trusts the access control server that sits in the middle. So as long as the access control server says, you're good, you have a valid token, it passes authentication, and then it passes that token to you, and you use the same shared key to say, oh, this is a valid access control server token, it hasn't been tampered with, and I can deserialize it and get my data out of it, then I'm good, right? I don't need to care about the passwords for this particular user. It's very, very powerful. Sure.
So how about balance between usability and personalization? So if you have like a fairly simple application, like in your case, right?
Mm-hmm. Right, so...
And you want to balance because like as soon as, like, according to description, it's a simple application, but as soon as users see the login screen, say, okay, forget it.
Yeah. Yeah, I understand that. So the question for those that are online is, how do you balance the complexity of doing those logins with, you know, being able to just save and use information? So one of the things was that... the access control server and claims-based authentication takes away the actual login mechanism where you're doing username and password. It doesn't take away some of the extra security concerns like authorization, right? What roles that user is in, what can they do, what can they access, how do you get their data? So you probably will be writing some services that augment the data that you get from your claim and say, let's add some information about who logged in, right? So there may still be a registration to say, well, Facebook told me that your email address was this, but do you want to use a different email address for my service, right? As long as I have the unique identifier from Facebook to say that was that person who logged in, I can augment that with another set of data. Now, to your other point of your question, where you want to make it as easy as possible to get people on board with giving you data, that's where things like already signed in services like on the surface here where you're actually logged in as your live ID and so performing this operation. So if you run a browser window on the surface that says go log into live, because you're logged into live on the surface and Internet Explorer is connected, it's already logged in. It'll come back right away. They won't even see that login screen and it's going to get redirected to ACS. Stuff is going to happen. It'll take about a second, but they won't actually see that login. So that's the kind of solution for making it easy to log in is having these concepts of cookies and devices that automatically have user identification that where you can actually say that you're already logged in. You don't need to go to a username and password. For myself, like different users have different preferences. Me compared to my wife, for example, I don't care that my Facebook is logged in all the time. My Google is logged in all the time. Like I go back to Google Reader constantly. I access probably about 6 or 8 services, including Azure, that relies on my Live ID login. So I'm logged into Live ID with a cookie on my computer all the time, right? I don't often see a login for those services. However, there are some folks like my wife who automatically, when they're done using something, will say log out, right? So that's just something that you have to kind of be aware of, and hopefully they understand, like, well, you're only really getting this screen because you were persistent about logging out of Facebook every single time, right? And so if you don't like login screens, then check off that box that says remember me, and then just close the window when you're done. Stuff like that. So I understand the issue, so you kind of have to understand who is actually using your application, which of these services they may be using, right? So Access Control Server gives you the opportunity to use any number of login mechanisms, right? But depending on your audience, you may want to use one more than the other, right? You're not going to use Active Directory Federation services for enterprise logins if you're targeting, you know, home users or people that are on social networking. No, you're just going to say login with Facebook, right? You're just going to focus on Facebook as your primary login if you're using a social networking application. If you're using an application that augments a Windows Live ID or you want to use on the Surface, then you're going to use Windows Live ID to log in, right? Because it's very easy. So you kind of have to target the people that you're interested in.
Last question.
Sure.
And how do you partition all this, like, four repositories based on user? So you have four different types of repositories, right?
Yeah. So
how do you partition them depending on what information is related to what user?
So the main thing is that lots of times I would sometimes keep a record for what their log, if you give them the option to choose a login mechanism, I would keep a record to say, sorry, I need to repeat the question. The question was that how do you actually manage any extra information that you're attaching onto a user that has logged in? Is that kind of?
No, in the case of table, how do I associate user with the information that has been stored?
Yes. Okay. So the question was, how do you actually reference data for the person who's actually logged in? So this, let's go back a little bit. So this data that comes back from Facebook or Live ID is a serialized dictionary, basically, of simple information that of the user that's logged in, like their unique identifier, their email, their name, possibly their phone number if they've put it in, if they've allowed you to actually read that information. So this token, as much as it is a verification that they're logged in and it's, you know, a shared access signed, it's also a set of data, right? And so when that token goes to Access Control Server, it massages it into, again, a set of data that's serialized into Base64 string that's just, you know, this user logged in. It might ignore a few claims if you want to shrink that set of data down. All you really need in most cases is, you know, the name, the email address, and the unique identifier. So when that claim comes to your application, you use what's called a claims principle. So when you're doing ASP.NET development, you can say current context.user principle, and it will access the current user principle of the person that has logged in. So ASP.NET does all the heavy lifting of taking that header, dissecting it, deserializing it, splitting that dictionary out into a claims dictionary that you can just say, well, give me the entry in this dictionary that corresponds to their unique identifier. And once you have that out of the claims principle, then you can use that as a reference to your tables, right? You can say, you know, the primary key or the partition key is this user ID, and the row key is, you know, their email address or their name or their friends or their images or different things like that. So does that kind of answer your question a little bit? Great. I probably spent a little bit too much time on some of the authentication stuff. I've done entire talks on this, so it's very complex. And there's, like I said, there's a variety of different options for you to use. Everything from just implementing ASP.NET membership and doing it all yourself, all the way to federating to Office 365 and Active Directory to do your authentication for you. So After authentication and identity, the next big feature of actually providing a cloud service for your applications is being able to communicate from the cloud to your application or communicating with other users, right? So how do we actually do that? We can do that in two forms with most of the devices out there. I'm kind of focusing on Windows 8, Windows Phone 8. There's device initiated and there's cloud initiated. Device initiated means that I have a background thread that wakes up every 5 minutes and says, hey, do you have any messages? No? Okay. Right? 5 minutes later, do I have any messages? Oh, you have one. I'm going to put a one over here on my tile because apparently I have a message. Right? So that's a very valid and perfectly good mechanism for communicating and giving toast messages and tile messages and different things like that for your application. The other one that's the problem with device initiated, I'll do this one last point. The issue with device initiated is that you need the processing time, the network bandwidth, that's wasted basically saying, do I have a new message? And you have a lot of background tasks. Like say, like my phone, for example, has over 50 applications installed. Well, what if all of those applications had background tasks that were checking every 5 minutes if you have messages? That's a lot of data, a lot of processing time. So this device initiated was not the first option that they implemented with Windows Phone. There was no background tasks in Windows Phone 7.0. In 7.5, they allowed you to do this, right? Because in a lot of situations, it's a lot easier, it's a lot better. But cloud initiated is the main and probably best option for you to send messages to your device. So let's see. There's a couple of different modes or let's see, this is for the Windows Phone. So there's a few different notifications. So on Windows Phone, this is called push notifications. And you can have a toast notification, you can have a tile notification, and you can also have what's called an in-app notification. So an in-app notification only actually shows up and calls into your code when your application is running, right? Which could be useful in some senses, but it may not be useful in most senses, because who knows if they've uploaded that image and they're waiting for it to be rendered, they probably just closed your app and they're doing something else now. But you want to send them a toast message when the background process that's happening on the server is completed, or one of their friends wants to send them a message, or you know they're late for a meeting or something like that, right? You want to send some information from the cloud, and so you have this little tiger, I have no idea why this is on here, that actually shows up right out of nowhere almost, and sends this message through a persistent connection that your phone always has open with a Microsoft server that brokers your notifications. And this is the same for Windows 8 and Windows Phone 8. So that's the Microsoft Tiger, I have no idea. So it pushes data to your application. Your application doesn't necessarily need to be running. It's going to handle the tile or toast notification no matter what. So how does this actually work? So the device, when the device starts up and you install your application or any application onto your device, it requests a persistent channel. So this persistent channel goes to a server, essentially a notification server that's sitting on the Microsoft cloud somewhere. It's actually hosted in Azure, but it's hosted by Microsoft. So that server or farm of servers actually manages persistent channels to all of the devices that are out there connected to the internet, right? Obviously, this means that you're not in airplane mode. You actually have internet access through some means, like through your data provider and wireless, or through a Wi-Fi connection, either way. In either way, you're actually connected to a channel. So it's a two-way connection. So you initially make the request and say, like, hey, I have an internet connection. I can accept messages. And it gets a response back in a persistent tunnel so that the actual server there can actually send data from the cloud, essentially, or the internet, to your device. So your device is interacting with your website or web role. It's doing stuff, right? And you actually have a unique URL that says, hey, this is my notification service URL for this device session, this user, at this time, right? So this changes constantly, right? You have to keep updating this. If you do this once and trust that it's still the same all the time, you're probably going to have issues. Eventually, they'll just expire. So pretty much every time your application starts up and your user starts to do something, you should be updating this URL. So what happens? when the cloud service needs to send a notification, like when your friend messages you and you actually want to show a little toast notification, it doesn't directly communicate with your phone. You as the cloud service don't ever message someone's phone directly. You actually send a message to this Microsoft server, and it relays that message down to the phone through its persistent connection. Now, that is the cloud-initiated push. Let's see. Yeah, so the thing is, you can't always rely on these messages. They're not guaranteed delivered. They can fail. Sometimes your cloud service will get a response that's an error response, and it'll say, oh, that failed, right? I'm going to retry. And you can have some retry logic. Sometimes you get an OK response, and you say, and it says, the cloud server that handles notifications accepted your message. That doesn't mean it delivered it. It just has it. It's responsible for it, right? However, there is still a point of failure in that the notification server may not deliver that message. So as a precaution or just a common practice, when your application opens, the application should be checking for any messages anyway, right? Is there any toast notifications that I didn't get, right? Or how do I need to update my UI to properly represent the messages you've been sending me, right? So it's still a little bit of work, and this is where lots of those queuing mechanisms can come in, where you actually have a queue of those messages. So every time you send a toast to the notification server, you also save that toast to a table or to a queue. So the next time the application actually runs, it will actually get all of those notifications and say, okay, well, I have all my messages now, thanks. Everything is fine. And so you actually are downloading those messages from your web role or worker or website. So obviously, there's a variety of different devices out there, and different mobile platforms support different notification services. The best place to go for notifications is actually the mobile services, Windows Azure Mobile Services, which currently supports Windows Phone 8 and Windows 8 notifications, and will soon support iOS and Android notifications as well. So these are all the kind of four notification services that you should be aware of. Windows 8 and Windows Phone both use, kind of the same, Windows Push Notification and Windows Phone Push Notification, or Microsoft Push Notification Service. They're fairly similar. They have fairly similar APIs, but there's just slight differences between them. And then there's Apple Push Notification Services, and then Google Cloud Messaging, which is the Android service. They all have similar concepts of sending a toast message. Not all of them have the concept of updating a tile. That's pretty much something that's for the Windows 8, Windows Phone 8 type people. Most of them have like a message or some sort of toast or notification structure. So there's different functionality between all of them. So depending on which device your user is actually running on, you may want to store that information as well as their key and some of their data, so you understand which of these services to actually use to communicate with them. So how does this actually work? Let's actually go to the point of interest controller, I think. I think it's this one, actually. Hold on a sec. Right. So this is my, for those who are just joining, this is my sample application that's called Party Server that actually runs on Windows 8 and communicates, and you can send a picture that's associated with the location where your device is, and people can see push pins on a map and basically see what's all going on around them. So in my post message for sending a point of interest, it's also sending a notification. So what is this? What's in this send notification here? This is a fairly basic system. So what it's actually doing, obviously this is a demo application, you'd never actually do this in reality, but it's sending a notification to all of the endpoints that it knows about, all of the people that actually have opened this application, and basically saying, hey, there's something near you that's going on, here's a picture. right? So it's going for each in the notification service context, basically the data context, the configuration, storage provider, and all of the items, right? So what it's actually doing is generating a title that has a text box and a subtext box, this isn't, like, it doesn't have a lot of functionality, but you kind of get the idea where you could put certain text or sub-block text in your tile to show the message that the other person put together for their, you know, point of interest or their party that's going on or something like that. But right now, the basic concept of it is you have a factory that's creating, an image source, right, a tile image, and setting some text and subtext. So a little bit of a difficult thing is that you have to kind of understand what your client is. In this case, it's targeting Windows 8, so you have a text block and a subtext block, right? If you were targeting Windows Phone, you would have a front text and back text, because tiles on Windows Phone, they flip over, right, periodically. Right, so there's a different concept there. Unfortunately, that concept, that kind of design-oriented concept, is on your server side. Right, that's not usually where I want to worry about design, is on my server. But it just so happens that this is, you know, the contract that I'm stuck with. I have text block text, subtext block text. I can set the block images and different things like that as well. So all I really need to do is. Let's see, where's my endpoint here? Wide, yeah. So the tile content factory is creating a wide peak image, and this is actually providing my contract. Let's see if I can actually go into what this does. Nope. So this is actually part of the notifications extensions. So you can actually use some extensions from NuGet to actually send these notifications through there. So what I'm actually doing is I'm sending the notification to the channel URI of one of my endpoints with my token provider. So I have a token provider at the very top, which basically says that this is my app ID, right? I can send notifications. Obviously, they can't open it up for anybody to send notifications to anybody. So I actually have to register my app, get a token, and do all that fun stuff. When are we finished this session? 11:30? Yeah, thanks. So this is essentially how you would do the notification stuff. And is it 11? Oh, yeah, right, because we started at. Yes. Okay, well, I have probably about 10 more minutes, and then we'll take questions. So, well, and I'm at the summary, so I probably have like 2 more minutes, and then we'll take questions. in summary, devices plus cloud equals winning. Worst title ever, but I didn't come up with it. And so what are the really huge benefits of actually using a cloud service for your device? Storage, identity, communications, and platform services, right? So I don't want to learn all these new languages, all these new platforms for writing mobile applications. I want to centralize my business logic into ASP.NET or PHP or Ruby or whatever, something that I can host on the cloud. I don't really have any toolkits for you because a lot of them have been currently deprecated, but one of the main things to go look at if you are building a mobile application for Windows 8, Windows Phone 8, or iOS and Android right now is go look at Windows Azure Mobile Services. It's turnkey, right? You can go to mobile services. Actually, in fact, I have a few minutes. So, and this is my blog, tylerdirksen.com. And so, see if I can actually do this. Sure. So let's see how fast this actually creates. I don't think it's going to create very fast. But I already have one going here that I was just kind of trying out. So if I wanted to create an application on these platforms, I can say, create a new Windows Store application, right? Generate the tool items. I can pick my language here, C# or JavaScript, and I can hit download. And what do you know? I actually have a full solution and project for accessing that data. It's done, right? That's for Windows 8. I can do the same thing for Windows Phone 8, right? You create a new Windows Phone 8 app, download and run your app. It's just going to download another solution and package for running my Windows Phone 8 application. You can even do it for iOS, right? So here, I don't have Xcode or whatever, but I can still download possibly a zip file that has Patingo and, let's see, Xcode Proj and all this other stuff, you know, and all of my iPhone storyboards and Objective-C stuff. I won't say junk. Anyway, so it's very, very easy to do. You can just say, okay, well, this is my data. I've got users. It has one entry. I can browse them. I can script out what happens when you actually insert or update, right? I can put some JavaScript code in here to actually do some server-side logic. It's very, very easy to do on this application here. And I can go back here and say, oh, this is already done. Now, I actually didn't add the table that I already had in there. And as well as accessing data, I can do push notifications with different client secrets for Windows and Apple. Actually, Apple isn't on here. I said that it wasn't before, but it is. I can provide identities, so I can say Microsoft account settings. Let's register for a client ID, client secret to access Microsoft account stuff. Facebook, Twitter, Google, right? Just put in the information for these things, and you can authenticate with them. This is not using Access Control Server. This is just configured right into mobile services, and your application is going directly to those identity providers. But it's very, very easy to do. And obviously, because this is actually a Windows Azure website under the covers, it's using Node.js. So because this is a Windows Azure website, I can scale up. Right now, I don't have any reserved capacity. Now I can switch to reserve capacity and say, like, oh, yeah, this is actually a 3 reserved instance system, right? It has a lot of processing being done here. And scale up my SQL database at the same time. Access logs. There's a whole bunch of different things you can do with mobile services, and it's all online. It's very easy to get up and running. I'm really sorry for anybody who was participating in the hackathon that I didn't tell you about this yesterday, because it's very easy to kind of say, oh, well, I just need a service that I can log into using Microsoft account that sends me push notifications that saves data. Well, half your work is already done, right? You can easily just create tables, access those tables, add that code to that client application that you've downloaded, done. Very, very easy. So if you are using Windows Azure and you're creating a mobile service, or you're creating like a sample application, or you're trying to convince somebody that cloud is the way to go and you can create a really cool, enterprise-ready application for them, definitely take a look at this for a proof of concept. When you're putting anything really into production, right now the mobile services are in preview, so there's minimal full support for them. So definitely not really a production system, but it's definitely something to start looking at when you just want to focus on the device and not necessarily on the cloud. Anyway, so in summary, there are session evaluations. Who was here yesterday? Okay, and we're doing something different with the session evaluations. They're not doing this crazy, huge Microsoft-based thing. It's done with poll everywhere, and this basically says they're not saving your information. They won't call you. Don't worry about it. You can come back to me if you really want the legalese with that. But this is a session evaluation, so winapi.ca/cld4eval. So this is the Cloud 4 session. There's 2 questions. They have 2 radio buttons. Takes 2 seconds. You can do it on your phone. You can do it from anywhere. And your feedback matters. So it'll say, was this good and was I good? I forgot what the 2 questions are. So definitely CLD4 eval for your session here. And I think that's pretty much it. This is provided by Microsoft, and I'm I'll just open it up to any questions. I'll see if I can log into the online system to take any questions there. So right now, does anyone have any questions about mobile applications in cloud? Any ideas that you are kind of have? Or yeah? No. Let's go ahead. Yep. Yes, I can.
And I assume that the magic that you showed, the code generation, is going to generate client, but server side.
The server side is mobile services, so that's already started up and ready for you. Okay. Right. When I clicked create, it was already done. So now this is the Windows 8 demo that I've been hammering away at. Obviously, you can see some processing usage. All I really did was this button here that says download publish profile. Right after I created this website, and I went into my Visual Studio here, and in Solution Explorer, I right-clicked on the party server. Right, so this is a regular ASP.NET MVC application. There's nothing specific to Azure about it, other than it uses some Azure API assemblies. I right-click on it and say publish. Let's see. So I've already imported my publish profile, but I can go to previous here so you can see what that looks like. So I actually have that, so I can actually import another publish profile if I really want to, if I have a different website that I want to deploy this to. And go to next, and it has, you know, the service URLs for the import. Obviously, it's a different publish URL, not my regular one. So all this is set up for you, even the password. When you download that profile, all this is already done. And then you can even do some other things like data string manipulation, right? If you're using a different database after you do the publish than when you actually have it locally, this publish profile can actually change and update those data strings, those data connection strings. And then you can preview, like if I change something and I said start preview, it'll only upload the files that I've changed. Now, that being said, there's a couple of other options here. So on the side, you can say set up TFS publishing, set up Git publishing. If you want to use Git, you can actually make this into a Git repository and push changes, basically, to this repository. There's also an FTP hostname, right? If you're using Dreamweaver or any normal run-of-the-mill, like you want this to be a site, like I've got my blog hosted on websites, so if I wanted to update the underlying files in my WordPress blog, I can actually log in using an FTP server and delete them and modify them, right? So lots of really, really good stuff that you can use, lots of rich capabilities. And like I said, it's IIS hosting and web hosting on crack. Atlee is actually going to be in here in the next talk and talking more about websites and how all this works and what are the different deployment structures and stuff, but I can show it to you right now, and maybe you don't even need to go to this talk. Anyway, is there any other questions? Looks like the wheels are turning a little bit. All right, then thanks very much, everyone. Like I said before, you can contact me at blog.tylerdirksen.com, please enjoy the rest of Pure Imagination. Thanks.